McKeague came in with little fanfare but great commotion at the end of the next week, surrounded by a score and more of soldiers, including several of the men who had sailed north with Branson, Kaydale, and Callan. Most of his entourage, though, was of longtime vanguardsmen, all toughened by years of battle. The way they rode, the way they dismounted, the way their weapons came easily to their hands spoke volumes of that.
A fine morning, made finer by the sight of you.
Dawson stayed up on his horse, as did the armed and armored warriors flanking him, several to either side. Branson lurched suddenly and appeared as if he would have fallen had not Callan and Kaydale grabbed him at the last minute.
You need not do that.
Well, we're not to let him fall on his face now, are we?
I mean that he need not do that. You, Branson Garibond, there is no need to wear your mask of the cripple here.
Branson wasn't faking, for he had let go of the gemstone.
Do not mock my husband.
Your husband? The highwayman?
I know not what you mean. Have you come here to mock us? You promised us news of Brother Brandonard.
He is dead. I am sorry. Truly. Brandonard died on the road more than 20 years ago on his way to Chapel Abelle. He never made it. The brothers think it was a Powry attack, which seems likely, as the holdings were at relative peace in those times. But Powrys remained thick about the land.
Good.
How did you discover this?
The brothers told me back at Chapel Abelle.
You lied to us.
I did, and I admit it. But I did it for your own good. And stop your lurching and drooling, man. Did you really believe that you could travel the length and breadth of the land in such an obvious guise? Word was run to every chapel in Hants to beware the man they called the Stork, for he slew Laird Priday and left Pride Holding in turmoil.
That is a lie.
Please, good lady, I am not your judge. Nor did the brothers of Chapel Abelle wish to pass judgment, but they would have had no choice. Indeed, they thought they had no choice. But I offered them one of mutual benefit.
Liar!
And your husband's alive because of it.
Enough!
Welcome, highwayman. Your reputation precedes you.
Branson stared at him hard.
If I had said nothing, if I had left you there, the brothers of Chapel Abelle would have taken you in chains and handed you to the nearest laird faithful to Laird Delaval. They wish no such thing, but they were bound, surely so. You can understand that.
Branson didn't reply, didn't move at all.
You were passed on the road by Brother Fottus, from the Chapel of Precious Memories of Palmaristown. He arrived bearing news of the Stork, the highwayman. They watched your approach before you ever neared Weathergard. I offered them a deal, for your sake, for my dame's benefit, and to relieve the brothers of their regrettable duty.
To take me here to fight in your dame's war?
We are in desperate need of strong warriors, and as I said, your reputation preceded you. The acting steward of Pride Holding warned all of your prowess with the blade. You are a deadly sort, I am told.
I want no part of your war.
There is no choice to be found, I fear. You have nowhere to go, nor do your beautiful companions.
You threaten them.
Our fight is a good one, not like the meaningless slaughter in the south. We battle goblins and glacial trolls, evil little brutes all, and heathen barbarian murderers who steal in at night and slaughter our children in their sleep. We battle some hastes, and I have heard you have no love for them either.
You seem to hear a lot.
True enough. I regret my lie, and I humbly apologize. Without it, you would be long dead by now, and your beautiful wife widowed. But still, the need to so lie left a sour taste in my mouth. But that lie is irrelevant now, for the deed is done.
Just let us leave.
To go where?
Anywhere that is not here.
Will you swim across the gulf, then? Or run west, all the way around it, through the wild lands where monsters and hungry hunting cats and bears are thicker than the trees? Be reasonable. There is no choice to be found.
We will find a boat sailing south to Hants, or to Bear even.
None will leave before the winter's end.
Then we will wait.
Enough, highwayman! You are fairly caught and already convicted in the South, where the sentence would be death. I offer you this alternative. You will march with Dame Gwydra's forces. Many of the same men who shared your boat ride to Pyrrhth Vanguard in a goodly campaign. We are desperate here. I am not asking you for this service.
Meaning?
Meaning that if you refuse, your life is forfeit.
Branson narrowed his eyes and squared his shoulders.
And so are the lives of your companions.
How dare you?
Dawson tugged his horse around and began walking it away.
Say your goodbyes then, highwayman. We leave now. Serve us well through the winter campaign. If we fight back the Samhaste Horde, you will be returned and all crimes forgiven. I offer you passage anywhere in the world Lady Dreamer can take you. That is the best offer you will ever get, highwayman. I can legally have my soldiers kill you and them right now by order of Dame Gwydra herself. Now gather your things and say your farewells. We have a long ride this night and a longer one tomorrow.
We could find our way out through the back window and over the wall. We'd be gone into the thick forest before Dawson and his men ever knew we'd left.
Gone to where? That forest is without end. Even if you and I could make our way, your mother is not a young woman.
Then you go out. Be gone, Branson, I beg. You are not for war. Your heart is not the heart of a soldier. When you are fighting men, Alpinadorans, who have not wronged you, will you revel in the kill?
No choice to be found.
Run.
And that will leave you and Callan to the mercy of Dame Gwydra. You heard Dawson's warning.
Dawson will not harm us.
He will, my lady.
Dawson was standing in the doorway.
Regrettably, but certainly.
Branson narrowed his eyes as he stared at the man. He instinctively grasped the hilt of his fabulous sword at his side, but he could not deny the truth of Dawson's logic that the monks would have killed him to avoid the wrath of Laird Delaval.
You do not appreciate our desperation. We are pushed to the gulf. Entire villages have been slaughtered by the Samhaste aggressors and their monstrous minions. Entire villages! Women and children and even the animals. I have no love of deceiving you. I feel not clever or happy with the act, but doubt not my words of warning. For your own sake, now we go.
Stunned with the sudden turn of events, Kaedale wrapped Branson in a desperate hug.
I will return to you, never doubt.
Concentration!
Brother Giavno shouted above the battle, raging again about the chapel's strong walls.
It is most important to your very survival.
The two younger monks looked at each other with obvious concern. And why should they not? For they were about to go into the middle of the barbarian attackers.
Brother Faldo, you must maintain the power of the Serpentine at all costs, except the spear in your chest, but do not allow the magic of that gemstone to dissipate.
Faldo rested the huge and surprisingly lightweight shield on one shoulder and nodded sheepishly. Behind him, the other young volunteer, Brother Morcris, moved closer and took his companion's hand, and together they shuffled for the secret door set in the wall. Just to the side of the main fighting, Morcris held out his open palm toward Giavno as he had been instructed, and Giavno nodded for Faldo to enact the serpentine shield. A moment later, a blue-white glow encompassed both young monks, and Giavno gave promising Brother Morcris a ruby, the Stone of Fire.
Charge into them!
Giavno nodded to the pair working the door. Giavno shoved the two terrified young brothers out, then fell back through the door quickly and spun about, throwing his back against the stone. He knew they wouldn't hold their nerve, and he was right. For the pair had barely moved from the outside of the door before the barbarians took note of them. Faldo did well to keep low behind his shield and to keep his thoughts on the serpentine, maintaining the magical protection. A spear hit the shield, then a second, but this was of barbarian make, woven of thin wood into layers behind a leather front, and those weapons did not get through the clever tangle. But the Alpinadorians didn't hesitate in the least and charged right in. and Faldo got rammed hard as his shoulder slammed against his shield, sending him lurching back and nearly upending him. To his credit, he maintained the serpentine barrier, but the jolt broke his grip with his companion just as Morcris sent his energy through the ruby and conjured a tremendous fireball. With the connection to Faldo broken, Morcris had no protection from his own blast, and like the poor barbarians caught in the area of conflagration, he was engulfed in his own flames. Brother Faldo, confused and dazed and having no idea of where to turn next, stumbled back through the smoke toward the door. He felt someone punch him in the back, but he managed to stagger through, and Giovanni and the others quickly shut and secured the portal behind him.
I held the barrier, but...
Faldo couldn't finish the thought, though, as he fell to his face. For that punch in the back was not a punch at all, but a spear that had driven deep into his kidney.
Get him to Father de Gilb!
Giovanni rushed for a ladder that would take him up to the parapets. When he got there, he found that his comrades were no longer raining stones on the attackers, and when he peered over the wall, he understood. For the Apinadorians were running off, and just below Giovanni, no less than 7 bodies, whether men or women, he could hardly tell, either lay very still or writhed on the ground in mortal agony, their clothing melted to their blistered and bubbling skin. He recognized the monk he had sent out there by the shape of the still-burning robes, and his instinct to run out and retrieve Brother Morcris lasted only the heartbeat it took him to realize that the young and promising Abelican was already dead. With a heavy heart, Brother Giovanni started for Father de Gilb's quarters, praying that Brother Faldo, at least, would survive. He paused at a group of several brothers, all staring hard at the gruesome scene below.
Go out to the secret door and see if any of our enemies can be saved. Be quick about it, and return at first sign that their companions are coming after you.
As soon as the brothers moved out to the writhing wounded, the barbarian forces from across the way charged with fury beyond anything Giovanni could have anticipated. The monks made it safely back inside, with one grievously wounded Apinadorian warrior in tow, but they had to secure the door fast. The Apinadorians came on with abandon, throwing themselves against the stone, smashing at it and seeming not to care about the rain of stones that came down upon them.
Bolt to that portal!
Of the 3 fights so far, that battle was the most lopsided, with another handful of barbarians dead and several more badly wounded, and not a monk seriously injured. But for Giovanni, that last battle was the most unnerving of all. The one that told him in his heart of hearts that these enemies who had come against Chapel Isle were willing to die to a man and woman to retrieve their brethren. He had never seen such ferocious dedication. Nor had Cormac, who had watched it all, the fireball, the retrieval, the second wave of wild assault, with horror.
We cannot win.
The 3 monks stood in a line side by side in Degil's office, facing the father and Brother Giovanni, who stood before the first, demanding his report.
They are not eating.
At the other end of that short line, Brother Cormac winced at every word. He knew it to be true. Andrusus and the others would not eat, not a morsel. The captured shaman had decreed that they would die before acceding to the wishes of their wretched captors.
Then make them eat.
We have. We hailed them and forced food and water into their mouths. Most they spit back.
But they got some. That is good. Their bodies will likely outlast their determination.
Likely.
When we returned to them the next day, they were covered in vomit.
Oh, bind them more tightly, that they cannot get their fingers down their throats.
Yes, brother.
The 4th has been placed with them?
Father de Gilb referred to the barbarian who had been caught in Brother Morcris's fireball. The man would carry horrible scars for the rest of his life, but through the miracle of the gemstone magic, his life had been saved.
Not yet, father. Brother Manok fears that his wounds will fester if he is laid in the dirt.
Then put a blanket under him.
He recovers well and should be ready for the dungeon.
He recovers in the dungeon or he recovers not at all. I will not have a dangerous enemy in our midst when again these people attack. Would you have him climb out of his cot and murder Brother Manok while he was distracted attending one of us?
He is bound.
Now, brother, to the dungeon with him. Be gone!
It is an unpleasant business. Hold faith, all of you. Keep in mind that our brother Minak was able to save two lives during the night, that of the burned barbarian and that of Brother Faldo.
Brother Faldo is not yet awake, nor is Brother Minak certain that he will recover.
He will.
The next monk in the line, the one standing right beside Cormac, offered details on the work at shoring up the walls and cutting stones and the like to hurl down at the barbarians.
They will not breach our defenses.
The assertion was ridiculous, of course, and spoken more as a cheer than a proper evaluation, but it seemed to satisfy the Inquisitor brothers, for Giavno patted the monk on the shoulder and moved to stand before Brother Cormac.
The water supply is inexhaustible.
And the fish?
The lake is full of them. They come to our hidden pond to feed, and are not so hard to catch.
Triple the catch.
Father?
Triple, at least. Our barbarian enemies will not relent, but they will pay too heavy a price to continue throwing themselves at our wall, I am sure. They will look for other ways to strike at us, and if they come to understand that we have this inexhaustible resource at our disposal, they might try to interrupt it. That we cannot have.
Yes, Father.
On your travels to the pond, do you look in on our guests? You are not prohibited from doing so.
Sometimes.
And it is as was described here?
They will not eat. They grow weak. They will not recant their beliefs and embrace ours, not at the price of their very lives.
Cordon Row.
The same monk who had just left to fetch the burned Alpinadorian and bring him to the dungeon burst in.
A messenger at the front gate. A messenger from our enemies approaches.
Bring him in?
No. He will learn too much of our inner defenses. Let us go to him and greet him at the wall instead.
As soon as he climbed the ladder to the parapet above the chapel's gate, Cormac realized he was looking at one, if not the, leader of the barbarians of Yosunfier. The man was a shaman, obviously, for he wore the same ornamental necklaces as Milkela, only grander by far, with his loose clothing decorated with shells and other trinkets, so that they rattled with his every step.
I am Tedru.
Cormac had indeed heard that name before, and knew then that he was standing before the absolute spiritual leader of Milkela's people.
You come uninvited to this place, Tedru.
You have three of my people.
Four. And all of them alive only through the holy gifts of Blessed Abel. Only through our work and healing powers.
Better they had died then.
Leave this island.
Return to us our brethren and we will be gone.
Your brethren are alive only through our efforts. They have felt the warmth and love of Abel.
Ha! They embrace your faith.
They begin to see the truth of Blessed Abel.
Bring them forth to speak.
You are in no position to bargain. You have attacked us three times, and three times you have been repelled. That will not change. Your people die at our walls, but we remain. You cannot win, Tedru.
We will not leave. We will not stop attacking you. You will have our brethren.
Or what? Or you will all lie dead at the base of our walls?
If that is what our spirits demand, we will not leave. We will not stop attacking you. We will have our brethren.
We will kill you all.
Then we will die with joy.
Tedru turned and slowly walked away. Father DeGilb and Brother Giavno lingered for only a very short while before heading back to the father's office. 4 tense days passed before the next attack, just when some of the brothers were beginning to whisper that the barbarians would besiege the chapel rather than assault it again. No such luck. And the reason for the delay became apparent very quickly. The barbarians had been training and thinking and better preparing. Nowhere was that more evident than when a pair of brothers went out into the throng, much as Faldo and Morcris had done. The horde retreated from them at full speed, while others, farther away, launched a barrage of spears and rocks at the brothers that had them scrambling back toward the wall. Pursuit came swift, and, to the credit of the monks, they had maintained their concentration on the serpentine shield throughout, and so they were ready to counter with a dazzling fireball. But those nearest Alpinadorians, obviously expecting the blast, quickly veered aside and, more impressively, they had come wrapped in water-soaked blankets. A couple were wounded, only minimally, but suddenly the two poor brothers found themselves under brutal assault. Thank you. Lightning bolts lashed out from the wall, along with a barrage of stones. Several barbarians fell grievously wounded, but so too did the brothers fall side by side. They would have survived their wounds, likely, had not the monks on the wall continued their barrage at the approaching horde. For the attackers wanted prisoners that they could exact as exchange. They couldn't get near the fallen brothers, though, in the face of that barrage, so they settled for the next best option. The Alpinadorians rained another volley of spears at the defenseless duo. On the far side of the chapel, the western wall, a second wave crept up and then broke into a charge, knowing that most of the monks were across to the other side trying to help their fallen.
Go, go, go!
The group of monks leaped down from the wall and rushed across to see brothers on the opposite parapets already engaging the ferocious enemy. The others ran ahead of Cormac as he slowed to a stop. He glanced back at Brother Giovanni and the continuing battle at the eastern wall. He went to the side structure of the keep and to the bulkhead, where he picked up a torch and slipped down into the tunnels. He went to the dungeon where the four barbarians sat miserably side by side.
Your people come on again. Men and women are dying up there.
You would have us renounce our faith. We would die first.
I know.
The simple answer elicited a curious look from both the shaman and Andrusus, and that gave Cormac some hope. He set the torch in a sconce and moved around the wooden wall.
We will venture deeper.
Cormac loosened Andrusus's bonds.
Because you fear my people will overrun your pathetic castle, you move us away in desperation.
Cormac hustled fast around the barrier to stand before the still-bound shaman.
Your people will not get through the wall. Not now and not ever. They will be killed to a man and a woman at the base of the stones unless we end this.
You doubt the power—
Shut up! More than 20 of your kin are dead already. More are dying right now. They will not relent and they cannot prevail. Their loyalty to you is commendable and foolish.
What would you have us do?
Cormac moved around the wall again and freed all three, with Tonike last. As they were freeing themselves of the rope and climbing out of the mud and the piss and the feces, Cormac went back to the sconce and retrieved the torch.
Follow closely, and as fast as you can manage.
And if we do not?
Cormac swung about, drawing out a knife as he turned.
This ends today. Now, I will show you the way out of here, or it ends today.
And why are we to believe you?
What choice have we?
To Cormac's relief, they all followed, with Andrusus helping the burned man, even lifting him in his arms and carrying him along. They went through the door at the tunnel's end into the chamber where the lake comprised most of the floor.
You are all strong swimmers, I would expect and hope.
Cormac started to strip off his heavy cloak.
I cannot.
We are not going back.
No, I cannot go into the water and open the grate as I intended. If I return to my people with wet hair, they will know of my involvement.
Great.
A simple netting with minor reinforcement. Beyond it is a short tunnel, an easy swim to freedom.
Andrusus stared long and hard at Cormac. He placed his companion down gently and waded into the dark pool, walking in until the warm water was up to his waist before ducking under. While Canrak, the fourth of the barbarian party, lent an arm of support to the burned man, Tonike stared unrelentingly at Cormac.
You are so afraid of my people.
Cormac brushed him off with a smirk and shake of his head, never taking his eyes off the spot where Andrusus had disappeared.
If it is not true, then why?
Because my god would expect no less.
Andrusus came up.
The way is clear. There's a short swim with open water beyond.
What about him?
I will get him through.
Andrusus walked over to Cormac then and dropped his hand on the monk's shoulders.
You are a good man.
That was all Cormac had to hear to know that he had indeed done the right thing. The cost to him might prove great, but whatever Father de Guild might do could not begin to approach the cost to Cormac's sensibilities had he continued to do nothing. They called him a multitude of names and seemed to create a new one whenever he put his sword to work. The dancing sword, the bird of prey, any and all adjectives and superlatives to toss upon this warrior who stood so clearly above all others. Whenever a new title was bestowed, all knew to whom it referred, for there was only one it fit, All the conversations came back to the name by which they all knew him, the name used in his introduction to the soldiers. The Highwayman, he was called, and more than one sturdy soul shuddered to think of meeting this man on a darkened highway in southern haunts. True to form, he danced this day, running about the battlefield, leaping and spinning, lashing out with his feet as he soared through the mobs and always striking mortal blows as he landed. Like a small tornado, he rushed through the battling throng, and as the enemies, this day they were exclusively the blue-skinned and ugly little trolls, were easily distinguished from his comrades, there wasn't the slightest hesitation in his movements and strikes. The warrior known as the Highwayman skidded to a stop to catch his breath and survey the field. Only one concentration of trolls remained intact. A group of about 20 formed into a tight wedge on the far side of the fighting.
20 trolls.
The troll wedge formation, appearing so formidable just a few heartbeats before, broke apart. The creatures running away from this madman they also knew by many names, all inspiring terror.
You did well in tricking that one.
Brother John Dumolnay spoke to Dawson McKeague as they watched Branson dance away in pursuit of the fleeing monsters. The monk continued his work on one of the wounded vanguardsmen as he spoke, pulling open the man's tunic to reveal a gaping hole in his chest, blood gushing forth. He went to work with his soul stone, summoning its healing powers to try to stem the flow.
It was for his own good as much as our own. Your church would have turned the man over to Laird Delaval, and he'd have been sacked with a snake, to be sure.
John rocked back on his knees, dropping his bloody hands on his thighs.
They would have sacked him. Not if they understood his skill with the blade. They would have sent him post-haste to the south to do battle with Laird Ethelbert, I'd wager.
The whispers have it that this highwayman rained particular embarrassment upon Prince Yezelnik, one of Laird Delaval's favored nephews. No, if Delaval had gotten his hands on that one, Branson would not have had the chance to prove his worth. And I doubt he would have battled for Delaval. He had a bit of a run-in with the Laird of Pride. Words that he'd killed the man.
Laird Pride himself?
His son, Prideay. You're knowing them?
I know. Or knew. The father.
And?
Probably deserved it. If the son was much like the father, I mean. Here comes your new champion. It'll take the Mesa Delaval itself to wash the blood from his blade, I fear.
Bloodier with every battle.
Dozen huzzas for Dawson's wit.
Branson approached, looking at Jund. When he took note of Dawson, though, he veered suddenly, his face growing very tight.
It is appropriate for a returning fighter to report his findings to his commander.
Branson stopped and stood very still for a few heartbeats, composing himself.
In fact, you should consider it required.
The beasts are all in full array in retreat. They'll not return anytime soon.
Good enough, then. Myself and my Abelican brothers near the limit of our magical energies. Another assault would see less magical tending of the wounded, I fear.
Curious!
All three turned to find Dame Gwydra sitting astride her roan mare.
From all that I have heard of Brother Jond, I would be certain that he would find more energy within himself, somehow, some way, if a man lay wounded before him.
Milady, when did you arrive in the field?
Be at ease, my friend.
You are much too kind, Dame Gwydra.
I only hear the whispers, good brother. I do not create them. Your reputation overrides your humility, and all of Vanguard is blessed and pleased that you are among us.
Despite himself and his sincere humility, Brother Jean couldn't suppress a wisp of a smile at that.
And you? The Dancing Sword, is it?
That is not my name.
It is Branson Garabond. Or perhaps he prefers the Highwayman, the name attached to him for his misdeeds in the south, the name for which he would have been sacked or hanged by the neck.
The Highwayman will do indeed.
Your exploits are not unnoticed, Branson. When this is ended, should you choose to leave Vanguard, I promise that my note of appreciation and pardon will accompany you. Though whether the southern lairds would honor such, I cannot say.
Should I choose?
What prisoner would willingly remain in his dungeon?
A bit of respect!
Vanguard is no dungeon, Branson Garibond. She is home. Home to many, many good people. You are free to view it in any manner you choose, of course. Never would I deign to take that choice from any man.
Yet I must fight for her, whatever my feelings.
Fight for yourself, then. For your freedom, such as it may be, and for the benefit of your young and beautiful wife, who does not deserve to see her husband put in a sack with venomous snakes. I care not why you fight, but I insist that you do. And while you may not see the good your fine blade is doing, we surely do. And while you may not care for those families given a chance to live in peace and security because of your actions against the Samhaste-inspired hordes, we surely do.
With that, she turned her own mare and walked it away.
One day you'll lose that stubborn pride, and you'll see the truth of Dame Guaidra, the truth of all this, and you'll be shamed to have spoken to her such.
Then Dawson, too, walked away. Branson stared at him as he left, unblinking, his eyes boring holes into the man's back.
You fought brilliantly today. I had thought the line lost and expected that we would be the ones driven from the field.
Branson looked at Jond, a man he had found it difficult to hate, despite his anger and his general feelings for Abelicans.
That may mean little to you. What field is worth the effort, of course, and you care not if Guaidra wins or Guaidra falls. But had we been driven from the field, this man would not have survived his wounds, and a woman not so unlike your wife would grieve forever.
Dame Guaidra does not care why I fight. Why would you?
Dame Guaidra has bigger things to care about than a single man's heart and soul, perhaps.
And Brother Jond does not.
My victories are smaller, no doubt, but no less consequential and no less satisfying.
Branson started to snipe back, but held his tongue and just waved his free hand in defeat, then walked off to be alone. Brother Jond watched him go with a knowing smile. Branson's anger was real, but so was his compassion. Indeed, later that very night, Branson and Jond worked side by side on the wounded.
You hate them?
Them?
McKeague and Dame Guaidra for a start. My brethren in the south as well. You are a young man too full of anger.
I am not as angry as you believe.
It pleases me to hear that.
But I have seen more dishonesty and evil than I ever expected.
Branson paused and bent low over a severely wounded woman, placing his hand on her belly and closing his eyes. He felt his hand grow warm. He couldn't begin to guess whether it would be sufficient balm to get her through the tearing and twisting a spear had caused in her bowels. After a short while, Branson opened his eyes and leaned back to see Brother Jond staring at him.
What do you do? What do you do to heal them, I mean? You've no gemstones, and yet I cannot deny what my eyes show to me. Your work has a positive effect on their wounds, almost as much so as a skilled brother with a soul stone.
My mother was a jester too. Do you know what that means?
No.
I did not expect anything different.
Jester too is a religion.
A way of life, a philosophy, a religion? Yes. And since it is not one of Haunts, but of Bear, I would hope that the Abelican Order has no reason to hate it. But of course they do. Why control people's lives only a bit of the way, after all?
There is no end to your sarcasm.
None that you'll ever see.
I know that your journey here was a result of a lie.
John spoke a long while later, as the two finally neared the end of the line of wounded.
But I cannot deny that I am glad you have come. As are they.
As am I.
The pair turned to see Dame Guaidra stepping into one of Brother John's conversations for the second time that day. Branson stared at her and did not otherwise respond.
Greetings again, lady. Your presence will surely uplift the spirits of these poor wounded warriors.
Soon. For the moment, though, I would speak with your companion.
She matched Branson's stare and motioned for him to join her outside the tent.
Your anger is understandable.
Guaidra led the way, walking across the encampment through a light rain that had come up.
I will sleep easier knowing that you approve.
The wind has a bit of winter's bite in it this evening. The season is not so far away, I fear. Our enemies will not relent. Glacial trolls feel the cold not at all. but my own forces will be more miserable by far.
A fact that little concerns you, I expect, other than how it might affect your holding, I mean.
Do you understand and accept why Dawson brought you here?
I understand that I was deceived.
For your own good.
And for yours.
Yes, I admit it. And though I knew not of Branson Garibond, this highwayman legend, when Dawson left Pyrrhoth Vanguard, and though I had no idea that he would so coerce you to come, I admit openly that I approve of his tactics and of the result.
You would say that standing out here alone with me?
Openly. I know enough of Branson to recognize that he is no murderer.
Yet my anger is justified.
Justified does not mean that it is not misplaced. I see that you have forged a friendship with Brother John and some others.
Branson shrugged.
If I granted you your freedom right now, with no recourse, should you decide to leave, would you? Would you collect your wife and her mother and be gone from Vanguard?
Yes.
Would you really? You would leave Brother John and the others? You would allow the troll hordes of the Samhastes to overrun Vanguard and slaughter innocent men, women, and children?
This is not my fight.
It is now.
By deception alone.
As you will.
You will let me leave.
No, I cannot. Though surely I would like to. For you and for all of the soldiers. There is too much at stake, and so I insist that you remain.
Dawson McKeague would be proud of you.
I do not wish to allow this war to go through the winter. The cold favors my enemies.
Please, end it.
I am considering creating a select team of warriors to strike deep into our enemies' ranks, perhaps to decapitate the beast. The hordes are held together by the sheer will and maliciousness of ancient Barden, a most unpleasant Samhaste.
A redundant description from what I've seen.
Indeed. Do you agree with my reasoning?
You're asking me to join your attack force.
I am tasking you with exactly that.
Branson stopped, and Gwydra did as well, glancing back and showing him all the time he needed to think it through.
How far and how long?
Somewhere in the north. Probably a journey of more than 2 weeks. And that if the enemy is oblivious to your passing.
If I go, and if this beast, ancient Baden, is killed, I would have my freedom. Even if this assault does not end your war as you hope, I would have my freedom with your blessing and am premature to return unhindered to the lands of Southern Haunts, and you will provide a ship to sail my family home.
You are in no position to bargain.
And yet bargain I do. Even if killing ancient Baden does nothing to end this war, I will have my freedom.
You will not walk away.
If you believe that, then you have nothing to lose.
Agreed, then. Bring me the head of Baden, and I will have Dawson McKeague take you back to Chapel Abel, along with my insistence that you be forgiven your past indiscretions, though I cannot guarantee that the Southern Lairds and Church will heed that imprimatur.
Allow me to worry about that.
They repel the assault, but not without cost, for this last attack by the determined Alpinadorians had left several brothers seriously wounded, one critically. The cost to the Alpinadorians had been even more grievous, with many carried from the field.
Fools all!
None of the monks around him dared utter a word in response, for never had they seen their leader so obviously flummoxed.
We will kill you all! Is this the choice you force upon us, fool Tadru? If you are concerned for your flock, why do you throw it to the hungry wolves? Idiots! They will not break through our walls.
Father de Gilb settled back against the stone parapet, letting the tension drain from his battle-weary body.
We will be working the soul stones long into the night. Determine a rotation and be certain that our wounded brethren are tended dusk to dawn. Of course. And if they come on again this day, conserve your magical powers. Let us ensure that we have the energy to heal our wounded. Repel the fools with stones and hot water.
With that, he took his leave, moving to the ladder that would take him to the courtyard.
If they break camp!
Father de Gilb stood there for a moment, looking up at the man, as did all the others, before they rushed wholesale to the wall to view the spectacle. As the lookout had reported, they watched tents being struck, the distant barbarian encampment bustling with activity.
Where are they moving their supplies?
To the boats! To the boats! They're taking to the boats!
Did we break their will at long last?
Soon after, all the brothers of Chapel Isle, save those already working the Soulstone magic on the wounded, gathered at the highest points on the southern battlements, staring out hopefully. Within an hour of the battle's end, the first sails rose up on the Alpinadorian boats, and the first paddles hit the warm waters of Mithranidun.
Perhaps they are not as foolish as we believed.
That sense of victory was soon enough shattered, however, when a breathless young monk rushed into Father de Gilby's audience chambers.
They're gone.
They?
The barbarians.
Yes, we watched them break camp.
No, the barbarians in our dungeon. They are gone.
Gone?
Out of their chamber and down the tunnel. The door to the pond was open and the grate has been dislodged. They are gone through the water and out, I'm sure.
As they came out of the keep, rushing around to the entryway to the lower levels, Giavno spotted Brother Cormac and waved at him to join them. They went to the dungeon where the empty cell stood.
This is my fault.
The others turned to regard Cormac.
I should have recognized their ruse, their unwillingness to eat.
What do you know of this?
It was an enchantment, do you not see? They were not starving themselves in protest to die before converting to our ways. At their shaman's instruction, they were starving themselves that he, or one of the others, could thin himself appropriately so that he could slip his bonds. Oh, but we should have guessed.
You babble. Let him continue.
Their magic is tied to the natural way. Perhaps. Yes, I think it likely. Their imposed starvation was merely so that their shaman could enact some spell to further thin his wrists and hands.
Those bindings were tight. I tied them myself.
That was many days ago. The captives were far heavier then, all of them.
You cannot know.
Agreed. But somehow they managed to slip their bonds. It all makes sense now. I fear their starvation, their confidence, their impudence. When we first encountered these people, before the lines of intransigence and battle were etched, I learned much of their ways, and I know their magic is tied to the natural. Their shamans have spells to make their warriors appear taller, to strike fear into their enemies. It is said that their greatest spiritualists can shape-change into animal form, much like the great Sam Hastes of legend.
So, you believe that their refusal to eat was a design to allow them escape?
Oh, it makes sense in the context of what I know about their type of magic. Oh, I should have guessed this ruse.
Search the whole of the keep, of the tunnels and the compound. Likely they went out to the open lake. That would explain the departure of their stubborn kin. But if they remain, find them post-haste.
The pair of monks started right out, sweeping Cormac up with them as they began their exhaustive search.
And doubly secure that grate! Brother Cormac thinks he has sorted out the mystery.
Perhaps he has. Though I wonder, if the shaman reduced his wrist and hand enough to slip his bonds, then why are all four of the binding ropes cut?
I should never have doubted you.
Milkela stood on the sandbar in Cormac's arms under a brilliant starry sky.
Speak not of it.
But Andrusus has already written songs to Cormac.
I beg of you. That battle, that siege, all of it is nothing I wish to relive or remember at all.
It was painful to you to see the truth of your church brothers. And to betray them.
And to see the truth of your people no less stubborn.
We did not hold prisoners. We did not invade your lands insisting you convert to our ways.
I know. And you know how I feel about it. And you know what I just did. Have you forgotten so quickly?
Of course I've not.
Then kiss me.
Milkela recognized that and smiled and did indeed kiss Cormac, surrendering to him as they slid down together to the sandbar. Sitting idly and alone in a small boat out on the lake, Brother Giavno had listened to their conversation, marveling at how well sound traveled across the dark waters on a night so clear. He wasn't really surprised that Cormac had been the one to betray them, of course, but it stung him profoundly nonetheless. The young and handsome brother, so full of fire and potential, strong of arm and strong with the gemstones, simply did not understand the meaning of what it was to be an Abelican brother as they moved toward the completion of the first century of their church. Brother Giovno had always liked Cormac, but hearing the man fornicating with a barbarian, a shaman no less, was more than his sensibilities could handle. Cormac glided his craft easily onto the sand, lightly scrambling out and dragging the boat the rest of the way out of the water. Another boat rested nearby, flipped over, and the two handlers, whose job it was to make sure that all the craft were properly stored and secured whenever they were not in use, rested aside the paddles of the first returned craft and hustled over to help Cormac.
Father de Gilbe wishes to speak with you. And what did you catch for us this day?
Cormac held up a pair of trout strung on a line. Fish that Milkela had given to him, as was their custom whenever they met on the sandbar.
You always do better when you're out alone. They should put you out there every day.
Cormac grinned and nodded, thinking that meeting Milkela at their special place daily wouldn't be so bad a thing. None of the three on the beach understood the prophetic nature of the remarks, however. Brother Giovno shot Cormac a withering gaze as he entered Father de Gilbe's chamber. That gaze immediately sent Cormac's thoughts back to the beach, to the second overturned boat, which had obviously been recently returned.
Father de Gilbe, I was told that you wished to speak to me.
Where have you been?
Fishing. I go often, and with Brother Giovno's blessing, I landed two this day, one of good size.
You fish from your boat or from another island?
The boat, of course.
Then why were you on an island? It was an island, was it not? Where you met with the barbarian woman?
Father, I...
You freed them. During the frenzy of battle, you slipped into the tunnels and freed our four prisoners.
No, Father.
Do not compound your crime with lies, brother.
Four souls for Blessed Abel, released to pursue heathen ways that will surely damn them for eternity. How will you reconcile your conscience with that, I wonder?
No. We thought they were not eating in protest, but it was an enchantment, perhaps, or
Brother Giovno followed you out onto the lake, Cormac. He heard you with the woman, all of it. And while your lust could be rather easily forgiven and atoned for, brothers often surrender to such urges. The action which precipitated your tryst is a different matter. How could you betray us like that? Men died to protect that treasure! The souls of four Alpinadoran barbarians. Four of your brethren are dead, and a fifth might soon join them. What would you say to their families, their parents? How would you explain to them that their sons died for nothing?
Too many were dying. Too many were still to die.
We would have held them.
Then we would have murdered them all. Surely there is nothing holy in that action. Surely, Blessed Abel...
Cormac lifted his head painfully to see the gemstone in Father de Gilbe's hand.
Strip him down and tie him in the open courtyard.
As Cormac was dragged away, Brother Giovno faced Father de Gilbe directly.
20 hard lashes. 50. And with barbs.
That will almost surely kill him.
Then he will be dead. He betrayed us beyond redemption. Administer the beating without remorse or amelioration. Beat him until you are weary, then hand the whip off to the strongest brother in the chapel. 50, no less, though I care not if you exceed the mandate. If he is dead at 40, administer the last 10 to his corpse.
Brother Giovno nodded solemnly to his superior and turned to leave.
Should he somehow survive the beating, or should he not, put him in a small boat and tow him out onto the lake. Leave him for the trolls, or the fish, or the carrion birds. Brother Cormac is already dead to us.
More than 2 hours later, the semi-conscious Cormac was unceremoniously dropped into the smallest and worst boat in Chapel Isle's small fleet as it bobbed on the low surf at the island's edge.
Is he already dead?
Who's to care? If he's still alive, he's not long for it.
Giovno stepped forward and tossed a red beret, Cormac's powdery cap, into the boat atop the prostrate, bleeding man.
It is a wound to every heart on Chapel Isle. Cast him out that the currents might take him to a cove where the beasts will feast, and when he is gone we will speak no more of fallen Brother Cormac.
Jevnot turned and walked away, and a group took hold of the small craft, guiding it toward the water. One man paused long enough to take the beret and set it upon Cormac's head, and when he looked at the curious stares coming at him from the action, he merely shrugged.
Seems fitting.
They brought the boat out onto the lake, giving it a strong shove to get it away from the island far enough so that one or another of the many crisscrossing currents caused by the underground hot streams that fed the lake would catch it.
If it washes back in, I'll tie it to another and tow it far out.
But that wasn't necessary. As a brilliant orange sunset graced the western sky, the stark, low silhouette of Cormac's funeral boat at last moved out of sight. He walked with a sure and determined stride that mocked time itself, for he had seen 7 decades of life and could pace men 1/3 his age. He stood tall and broad-shouldered, but his thick muscles had slackened, and his skin, so weathered in the northern sun, had sagged a bit. Still, no one doubted that the large fist of this man, Jamestown Sequin, could flatten a nose and take both cheekbones with it. His hair was long and gray, his beard not so long, and still showing hints of the darker colors of his earlier years, and his great and thick mustache stood out most of all. He wore a tri-cornered cap, one he had fashioned, one that had been considered unique when he had fashioned it. Long and narrow, it trailed back from a round pointed front to a flattened back that was just a bit wider than his head, and he kept a black feather along its right side, bent low to follow the line of the hat. At one of Vanguard's archery contests half a century before, one won by young Jamestown, of course, the man had received more than a bit of teasing regarding his rather unusual cap. Until, of course, he had explained that the pointed front allowed him to properly line up his shots. Within a few months, and to this day, the Jamestown, as the hat was called, was quite common among Vanguard's hunters, thereby adding to a legend that needed no enhancement. It was said that he was of Alpinadorian descent, or mixed blood at least, but his long nose and protruding brow spoke of ancestors along the southeastern coast of Hunt. His eyes were green, and his smile, though a bit snaggle-toothed now, was infectious and strangely disarming given the man's imposing stature and often withering glare. He was smiling now, as much out of curiosity as anything else.
This far north.
He moved far enough down the side of one mountain to better view the combatants in the dell below, which included men, apparently vanguardsmen. Now, more interested in the fight, which he had presumed to be another skirmish between various troll or goblin tribes, Jamestown quickly stepped closer, but to a higher perch with a better view. His first instinct at that point was to charge right in, for a quick glance made him realize that the small group seemed sorely outnumbered and sure to be overwhelmed. Before he had taken a step, though, he understood that such impressions didn't begin to tell this tale. The goblins, with a dozen lying dead already, were the ones in need of support. Jamestown drew Banewarren from his shoulder and set an arrow on its resting string as he watched the play. One man in particular, dressed in black from bandana to boot, had the old scout nodding with approval. The man raced the length of the line, leaping and spinning, his thin sword cutting graceful and precise lines through the air and through the goblins alike. Wherever that man passed, goblins fell dead. And though an Abelkin monk stood back from the action, ready to heal this man or any others who needed his magical services, Jamestown doubted he'd expend much of his healing energy on this one. A second, burlier figure crossed the black-clothed man's wake as he rushed out to the far left of the human defensive formation, and Jamestown smiled even wider. For this one, Vona Porlalone, he surely knew.
Crazy V.
She lived up to the nickname again, throwing herself with abandon into the midst of the goblins. Jamestown moved to find a better vantage point, testing the pull of Banewarren with every long stride. Vona carried 2 iron hand axes as solidly as if they were extensions of her living arms. Blood spattered and unbothered, Crazy V twirled about and sought her next target, and even took a step that way before an unusual red-feathered arrow whipped into the goblin and sent it flying into a tree. Crazy V's face erupted in a gleeful look of recognition. Only one man in this region was known for such fletching. She rushed off to find something to hit, because she knew that between a highwayman and his sword and their newest arrival, there soon would be few remaining targets. Branson was careful that his dance did not venture too close to the ferocious Vana. He always took pains to avoid that one. It had nothing to do with his personal feelings, though the crass and rude woman often left him shaking his head. Rather, it was because her fighting style was so unpredictable, so out of control, it could interrupt the flow of his own meticulous motions. He stayed nearest to Brother Jean, both to ensure that the monk was free to continue his gemstone healing and the occasional magical offensive strike, and because of the friendship they had forged in previous battles. The remaining two members of the strike force, a middle-aged, crusty old warrior named Crate and a red-headed young bull named Olcona, fell somewhere on the spectrum between Branson and Vana. Neither could match his grace or her ferocity, but both performed an effective enough combination of the two. Branson, out of targets now that Vana had charged into the middle of the goblin line and had, predictably, broken it, sending goblins running every which way, paused and managed to glance over at Crate and Olcona, fighting side by side behind Brother John. Branson nodded his admiration. These two had been fighting together for a long time now, and had made quite a name for themselves farther to the east and north, where the battles along the coast had been more scattered, but no less fierce. This one was over, at least, or soon to be, and Branson leaped past Brother Jean and charged off Alcona's right flank in fast pursuit of the now fleeing monsters, hoping to kill at least one more. He managed two and fast closed on a third when a red-fletched arrow beat him to the mark, throwing the goblin to the ground. Branson looked around to spy the archer, but no one was in sight, and none of his friends, still back in the dell, some 20 paces behind him, held any bows. Branson rolled the goblin enough so that he could push the beautifully crafted arrow right through. When he arrived back with his friends to present it, he found Brother Jean holding a similar one.
Our day's gone brighter.
Olcona looked awed.
It is him?
Crate nodded.
Aye. That'd be the mark of Jameson.
Jameson Sequin, a hunter of great renown who splits his time between Vanguard and Alpinador. It is said he knows the trails better than any man alive, and it'll prove a fortunate turn for us if he is indeed about.
There is the greatest understatement I've ever heard.
Vana nearly swooned as she pointed across her small lee, jumping up and down like a little girl getting her first view of a king.
It is him! It is him!
He is worth all that.
The approaching man's legs seemed just a bit too long for his frame, giving him as determined and forceful a stride as one could imagine. His face, weathered and creased, showed nothing but strength and a commanding pragmatism. Branson could see simply from the set of the man's jaw that this one, Jameson, wasn't loose with his words.
You're a long way north of Dame Guidra's lines. And you don't look like Samhace to me. Especially not you.
He nodded his gray-bearded chin at Brother Jean.
Hardly that.
Jameson's gaze fell over Branson, his face crinkling in a strange manner. For the first time since he had donned his mother's black silk suit, Branson felt a bit self-conscious about his unusual dress.
We did not come north just to find Jameson, but we're glad to see you.
Crazy V. Been a lot of years.
Too many.
And you too, Crate.
I'm surprised you remember me.
Not so hard a thing to do. How many might be living who have seen the fights you and I can claim as experience?
Two?
Might be.
Jameson, may I introduce...
Brother John! And Branson, the highwayman!
You wandered lost.
Here on purpose. The fighting has been terrible in the south. Entire villages are gone.
I've seen Baden's charges march out and figured as much.
The Samhastes know no moral boundaries.
You're a scouting band?
Half right. Dame Guaidra sees that we have to stop this war.
And negotiating with Sam Hayes won't get you far. You've come to kill Baden himself.
We will find him, and we will kill him, yes. He has earned the sentence.
100 times over before you were ever born, boy. Never been enamored of that one. Only thing I've found stupider than men who claim to speak for the gods are the people who listen to them. My apologies, brother.
Shand half shrugged, half nodded, seeming at least as off-balanced as Branson.
Help us kill him.
Never been one to pick sides.
But you have been helping Dame Guaidra. You have been sending reports south, so it said.
Counts of goblins and trolls and the like. And the second count I made of them after I left them was always less than the initial.
So you've already chosen your side, then?
Killing goblins and trolls isn't a side. It's a religion. Might be the only religion worth fighting for.
Well, since ancient Baden has thrown in with the beasts, he's chosen sides contrary to your religion.
10 days of marching east of here would get you to a hot lake called Mithranodun. Taking the trails west of that into the mountains will bring you to Coldrin, the glacier the hot waters hold back. Atop that is where you'll find Baden and his high priests. I'll take you to him. What you do once you get there, it's your own choice to decide.
The party of five just shrugged and followed. What else was there for them to do? After they made their camp that night, Vaughna and Jameson sat together, chatting like old friends.
They were once lovers?
Alcona and Crate were on the far side of the encampment, cleaning and sharpening their weapons.
More than once, if I'm knowing Crazy V. And I'm knowing Crazy V.
You as well.
Alcona looked back at the sturdy woman, shaking his head.
Had a problem for you. Make you think less of me, does it?
She's not so pretty.
She's the most beautiful woman I've ever seen.
Alcona put on a most incredulous expression.
And if she's there to offer you a ride, you'd be a wise man to take it.
Like everyone else?
Oh, but don't be going to that place. You spend your days killing people, and you're to judge one who takes a ride now and then?
But...
ain't nothing to bot about. Look at her, boy, and look at her well. Crazy V. She's living every moment with fire and filling her soul with memories and experiences most folks will never begin to imagine. She can outfight, outspit, outswear, and outfornicate almost any man alive and any woman I've ever heard of. She'll go to her grave without regret. How many of us can say that?
Alcona stared at Vaughna. Crate sat quietly, staring at the young warrior who had become his protege of sorts, and thinking that he had just given Alcona one of the most valuable lessons of all.